One, two, three. This is Dr. Alex Avila with Love University, and we're back. I'm an author, psychologist, and speaker. And every week we talk about how to love yourself, others, and a higher nature, how to improve your life and your love, relationships, and your spirituality, your finances, your career, and your health. And we've been having some great guests, and we have a wonderful one today, which actually, she's been on here before. And this is her second time. This is Dr. Paulette Sherman, who is a licensed psychologist, her specialty in romance and love. She was awarded Woman of the Year in Psychology for New York State. She has been a featured as an expert on CBS, Huffington Post, and the New York Times. She's the owner of a dating school and the author of Dating from the Inside Out and the Book of Sacred Baths. So we're going to get to learn how to do baths today. Welcome to the show, Paulette.
Thanks so much. It's a pleasure to be on again.
Yeah, we were just talking about how we did the LA Times Festival of Books, and we would love to have you come at some point. But I think you said you only take one honeymoon a year. Is that right?
Not even. This year we're finally going, and we actually did have our honeymoon in Dominican Republic, and there was a really cheap vacation, so we made it happen that we're going in June.
Okay, hopefully we can meet up at some point. Now, let me ask you this question now. You have a really interesting term here. You say dating from the inside out, and also how to make the right attraction, the law of attraction. So what does that mean? How do people attract the right mate?
How do people attract the right mate? Well, first of all, they have to come from really an authentic place. So one of the reasons I wrote this book a long time ago is that people were playing a lot of games and trying to please and be what they thought the other person wanted. Right. And then the kind of cosmic joke was that they didn't really know each other. And then, you know, it didn't work out long term. So I think the first thing is to kind of, what I say, marry yourself and know yourself and your essentials, the things you really need and the things that you really couldn't tolerate before you let your unconscious and hormones get in the mix and choose for you. So that's the first thing. And to be authentic and to be clear what your vision is and to really like your life and yourself, not to look to be completed, so to speak, or saved. Yes. Yes. And then to kind of date consciously, so that you can go about not looking for the perfect person, because there is no such thing, but just the person that matches you in the deeper ways.
Yes, definitely. Well, spoken like a true meaning seeker. I think you're Myers-Briggs. You're were you an intuitive feeler, if I recall, from last time?
I believe so, yes. And, yeah. I remember reading your book like quite a long time ago before you even contacted me. Definitely. So that's what I remember.
Exactly. Yeah. So you find meaning in relationships and life. Now, you know, for people like us, and I'm similar. I'm a meaning seeker in terms of the personality. You know, we value authenticity and meaning. But there are some schools of thought that people need to also adapt themselves to the situation in terms of dating or relationships. For example, you've heard the old line, playing hard to get. And they actually have done studies where women are more attracted to, or actually men are more attracted to women who are somewhat hard to get, even though they may not like them as much initially. So what do you think of that idea? Should people not necessarily show too much interest in the beginning? What's the best way to do that?
First of all, I'm probably colored by my own opinions versus maybe what is true for everybody. So if the research says that there must be some truth to that, at least I don't know when that study was done. However, there's also been research that shows that now that women are asking men out, most of them are like thrilled, 90% of them. And, you know, a lot of them turn into relationships that last a while. So I think things are changing. However, I think, you know, there was once a book quite a while ago, but it had a funny title. It was called something like Why Men Love Bitches or something like that.
I remember that misquoting one.
And I actually preferred that book a little bit to something like The Rules, because I felt like one was like playing games and acting like you're busy and it was inauthentic. And eventually, you know, the truth will out, so to speak. But in that book, it was more, it's not that it's great to be a bitch by any means, of course, but I think that was like a shock value title. But the point of that book was like to really like your life and to not need to be completed. And I think there is something to that, that men don't want to be pressured, or a lot of times, you know, women will just almost not care who they're marrying as long because they're hurrying up and they want to have a baby or get married.
Yes.
And they can feel that. So I think the idea of like it being their idea and having their own agenda and taking time sort of does work a lot of times, especially if they're a little bit ambivalent about commitment, which at least in the past, sometimes men are, right?
Yes, exactly.
More than women.
Well, if you remember, Paulette, in social psychology, there is the scarcity principle that we value things that are more scarce and they're in higher demand. So I think part of that, people sometimes want to present that aura, you know, that they're in demand in terms of the dating world. But you think, I mean, that is not a good approach to do. Should, I mean, let's say they have no dates, they're lonely. Should they admit that up front to the person they're with?
Well, that's not really attractive because they're not your therapist. So I wouldn't necessarily suggest like making it a session and saying, hey, nice to meet you, I'm so lonely. You know, they've been finding, and I don't know what you think about this, that, you know, there were several articles, even in the New York Times, that there were studies that when you ask deeper questions and kind of reveal yourself, I think there were like 30 questions, that people ended up getting married. So, you know, it's ironic that in the past, and I don't want to mention any authors in particular, but people have said like, oh, you know, kind of like play it cool. Don't really reveal yourself too much. Don't be needy. Right. But the truth is that if you're really authentic and you go deeper, sometimes the person sees your soul, so to speak, if you're looking for a soulmate, and there is that connection. So I think, it, you know, you could play it either way and probably find support. You're a lawyer, right? But either way for either side. But I think, you know, you don't want to come. No, neither sex wants to come across needy because that's just not attractive, right?
Exactly. I think the middle ground. But I think at the same time, if you find the right person, then some of the stuff that may not even matter. You know, if you're who you really are. Exactly. Maybe they're needy too. So two needy people, but you know, can help each other grow or something, right?
You have that nice, like, what do you call it? Folie à deux relationship.
Yeah, exactly. So that's possible. The other thing is interesting these days, Paulette, the idea of yin and yang energy. We've heard about the masculine and feminine energy. You know, that males sometimes are more feminine energy or softer, and women are a little more masculine. So in that case, you know, some people are given advice. For example, males who are sensitive and shy are told to be more confident and you know, be more masculine. Some women are very assertive, are told to be a little more so-called passive. And so what do you think of that advice? What should we do in that case?
What I wrote about in one of my books, which was When Mars Women Date, I barely remember anymore. It was a while ago. And it was about how career women can find the love of their dreams so that they could balance home and work. And so in those cases, the reason I wrote that book is because I still think that, you know, when men are from Mars, women from Venus could work for a subset of the population that's traditional, where the women are more feminine. But I also think that there are some women, maybe like myself, that tend more towards that yang energy, where they're big achievers and et cetera, and they might do better with the type of male who's more feminine. So I think it's all on a continuum, even, you know, gay relationships that, you know, I see clients with that. So it can totally change. And Freud said that too. I believe that, you know, it's really on a continuum and both people have both. So I think that it's just been something touted in the, you know, by a lot of experts that it has to be that way and that there can't be two egos in a relationship as well, which I do believe can be harder, but I don't believe it's impossible because you look at all the couples, like, you know, the high profile couples that really achieve a lot in the world together. They're almost like twin flames.
Yes. The power couples, they call them.
Yes.
But then, I mean, you hear of some of the celebrities that get divorced, you know, because they're very competitive as well and they're very high powered. But I think what you're trying to say is that if you really respect and understand and appreciate the other person's style, and we talk about that in love types, that could be the big difference. Because like you said, a more yang energy female with a yin energy male, they can respect each other. She could love his softness and maybe artistic nature. He can love her strength and guidance. But if you don't respect each other, there could be a lot of problems. You can imagine a lot of conflicts and disputes.
Yeah, but I definitely agree with that. But I also agree that that's no matter what the hell your dynamic is, right? Like, I mean, because there's going to be differences anyway. I do think also that I didn't want to overshoot in the book I was writing and suggest that, hey, it's great for all women to be yang and all men to be yin, because I think we all need a balance. And that's one of the things I was trying to say.
Yes.
So, yeah.
So it does depend on the combination. But speaking of, you just said that all marriages have conflict. Now, this is an interesting question. Is marriage
You're so well prepared. Okay,
good. Well, of course. Is marriage dead in our society, Paulette? Because we see 50% of marriages end in divorce, 60% of second marriages end in divorce. And there's a trend in some countries like Sweden to live together. Cohabitation is increasing. Is marriage dead or not really?
I was going to make a joke, and I'm trying to think about the medical term for the stage right before death. It's like kicking and screaming.
Oh.
I don't know what that would be.
Oh, really? Like you're turning purple, but you still have some life or something, right?
Exactly. So, I mean, I think that there were a couple articles actually a while ago, and some reporters reached out to me saying that, like, people reported that they're living together more and they're not getting married. And, you know, also we know half the people are children of divorce, right, and things like this. So I feel like people are really afraid. And I think there's also some cultural things where, number one, marriage isn't as needed, supposedly, like to have kids and whatever. And also women are making more. So they look at men sometimes, which is unfortunate for the men and for the women, I guess, and say, what do I need you for? Right. I can have a baby by myself.
Yeah.
And I don't necessarily think that that's always the case. But I think, you know, everyone has a right to decide for themselves. And one of the things I wrote about in that book a while ago was, I think the last chapter was about how they're all different types of relationships. relationships now, and people even don't cohabitate and get married. I read an article about couples that lived uptown and downtown and had kids. It's strange and don't have meet for dinner, you know. So there's all different types of things. There's open relationships now. So I don't think marriage is dead, but I think that, you know, just like anything, that the forms are changing and the values are changing. And I also think that, unfortunately, and I see this with my kids as well, like we're getting to be kind of lazy as a society in a sense with like fast everything. Even the dating is just overwhelming amount of options and technology and so many choices. And I think marriage is work. It's not easy. And it seems like you could just find someone else and you'd be happier. That's what people think a lot of times.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, in our recent, we were at the Festival of Books in LA, the USC, one I told you about. And we had an interesting guest who actually talked about the whole technology thing, how, you know, the new generation doesn't really want to commit as much. You know, they don't want to buy a house necessarily because they can, what's that when they get a house renting? What is that called?
Rent an apartment or
No, it's like some kind of app. What is it called, Reggie?
Like do that? Airbnb.
Oh, yeah. They do it. Yeah. Airbnb instead of buying a house. Tinder instead of getting married. Right. So, and I guess, I don't know, Upworks instead of getting a full-time job, permanent. You know, they want to travel. Do you see that a problem now, the lack of commitment in our society?
I'm smiling and nodding. I actually really relate to hearing that a lot. I do feel like that. And I do feel like, you know, maybe people are going to start renting dates, you know. And I'm talking about when I wrote my first book, Dating from the Inside Out, I think I wrote an article I was blogging at the time called, like, something dating in a Seinfeld generation, because even with him, like, he would, you know, date and then find that she wore the same dress twice or she had food in her teeth, so he would find somebody new.
Yes.
And, you know, it's kind of like, I do feel like sometimes things are very transitory. And I think it is good to have options and to feel like you're independent and things, but everything I think that's worthwhile generally requires some work, and that usually entails growth.
Yes.
And so, you know, I don't think that dating, some people date just to have fun and then they move on, and that's fine if that's the stage you're in. But I don't know if you can do that with marriage necessarily, although there have been books written about that as well, like getting married for a few years and then reevaluating, you know, and
yes,
that some people think that, you know, people, I don't know if it's Margaret Mead said that, but people aren't meant to be monogamous their whole life. So people have different views on it. Personally, I view marriage as a spiritual journey, and that's one of the things I'm writing about in my next book. Yeah.
Yes. That's what I was going to ask you about. Like, you know, from your personal viewpoint, what are the advantages of being married? Because obviously, you know, there's a lot of research on the health, and, you know, there's a lot of mental health and stuff like that. Well, give me a couple of big things that we don't even think about. What's so great about being married?
What is so great about being married? Well, I didn't say that it would necessarily be fun, but I think what's great about being married is that, your lifetime partner knows you better than anyone else. I mean, maybe not yourself and maybe not your parents, but really knows you well and sees you. And so they see your highest potential, hopefully, especially if they're your soulmate, but they also see the things that you need to heal in order to become whole. And we don't really see that on our own, right? Because we are just not paying attention. We're swimming in it. We're like the fish with the water we grew up with. So we don't really see our patterns. And sometimes that's really painful. And so when they start to annoy us or hurt us in some way by telling us what we don't want to hear, we think, oh, you're not nice anymore. We want to get someone who makes me feel great again, like the in love stage. And then we want to move on and get divorced. But if you can kind of work through that, it's an opportunity to learn from opposites, to learn about where you're not seeing things that, you know, you could heal old wounds and things like this. And so to me, that's really a soulmate relationship, and we're here to perfect ourselves. So,
I like that.
You know, not an easy sell.
That's a growth teacher personality, like you just said, right? The meaning seeker, a view of marriage. And that's beautiful.
Thank you. But speaking of
this whole idea of improving marriage or making it grow, there's certain like different factors. One of them, you've heard of Gottman's research. He did videotaped a lot of married couples and looked at their physical cues. It's something called turning away versus turning toward. So, for example, one of the partners talks about, oh, I have this great art collection. And the other partner, hey, I'm watching a football game. I can't be bothered. Or he says, hey, you know, I'm interested. Tell me more about it. And they said that happily married couples turn toward each other 87% of the time. And those are likely to divorce only 37%. What do you think of that idea of turning toward or turning away from your partner?
I remember, first of all, I wish he would name it something else. I think he's amazing, but that always confuses me when they say like bids for affection or bids for attention
like
or whatever.
That.
I think people don't know what it is a lot of times, but it's what you're saying, like any kind of little thing, like give me a hug, ask how my day was and you're ignoring me, anything like that, that goes into the emotional bank account. What I think is when I first read that, I was kind of in shock because to level with you, I feel like most couples I have, including myself, may not even pay as much attention as they used to 33% of the time. And those people were divorced 6 years later.
Yeah.
So it's a really good stat to kind of make you wake up. And I do have that in my book, which is talking about little ways that you can pay attention to your spouse, because those are the little things that actually add up over time. Yes. And then when there are troubled times, you can pull from that bank account, you know. So it's not like you're doing that with an agenda, but, you know, it's just so different, I think, the way people act when they date. And everyone whines to me how difficult dating is. And, you know, I can't wait till I get married. And I just look at them. I'm like, oh, they're there. Like, you don't have to know. Like, you know, dating is hard, but you're everyone's their best self. You kind of like have so much fun when it's the right person. And then there's all the responsibilities and, you know, all the, like I'm talking about, the things that surface. And that's where the real work, I feel like the deeper work begins, and the rewards can be very great. But, you know, it's very easy when you're dealing with the laundry and the kids and, you know, everything else you have to do, and you already got the person, to kind of like not pay as much attention and not be on your best behavior, so to speak, right?
Yeah, I like that. You said deeper work and greater rewards. So that's actually a very interesting phrase, because you're going much deeper than just superficial, I guess, attraction or, you know, comfort or companionship. You're talking about improving each other's lives in a deep way. So growth, it sounds like it's important here. But going back to this idea of you know, turning away or turning toward, what if you really hate art and you can't stand it? Should you be insincere and say, "Honey, let me tell you about the art, but I want to watch the football," or vice versa? How should they do that? Should they try to be?
Well, see, that goes back to the rules, right? That book was always like, "Oh, pretend you love football," and then later they find out you really don't.
Yeah.
So
exactly.
I don't think that you should pretend. However, like a lot of therapists and psychologists say, it's not so important to have shared interests or even to go to the football games, but what's important is shared meaning, and also to show interest. Like, so, you know, I might ask, like, how was that? Who won?
Yes.
You know, even if I really don't care.
Do you really care about football or any of that stuff or no?
I don't care about it. I don't know about it. And thank God my husband is not a big fan. I mean, that could change, but he's really not. We have a lot more in common than I think.
What if he loves the Giants, which I don't know if they're winning anymore, but let's say, and he says, honey, what do you think of the Giant quarterback? What do you think of
that
pass?
He wouldn't say that because he knows I have zero idea. Although, like, one time he did try to, like, teach me about it or something.
Right.
So, you know, I would... Maybe if I'm in the right mood, like my kids, especially my son watches the Super Bowl with him. I usually don't even want to watch. I have like too many other things to do.
Yeah.
But I mean, if he wanted me to, I would. And, you know, I don't think I would force him to go to the ballet per se or something.
Yes.
But, you know, he would, I think, if I really want him to. So I think, you know, it's good to have separate interests and separate friends and also enough time together. But you are still different people, and then also to compromise and try to support your partner. So it's a little of all.
Yeah, I think the term is empathetic listening, which, you know, therapists do that, kind of like reframing things and, you know, being attentive to them, even though, like I said, you might not be interested in what they're talking about, but you're interested in them as your partner, right? As your mate. Now, the other thing is, Paulette, and we're talking about, you know, how to improve a marriage or how to even save a marriage that's on the brink. They also talk about having appreciation for the person as they are. And, you know, in the very beginning, your mate is wonderful, right? There's nothing, you know, you don't criticize them. And they say that in the beginning of a relationship, you're always laughing. At the end of the relationship, only the divorce attorneys are laughing.
I thought you were crying, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, that's good.
They've seen that before. And then people become defensive, and then they try to prove their value. And that becomes a problem. How do people avoid that issue where they start to tear each other down?
Yeah. So you mentioned Gottman, and one of the things he found were the four horsemen. You're probably familiar with that.
Yes.
And there are different things that lead to divorce, different communication styles. And really, they all fall into kind of tearing the person down. So it's like attacking their character, condemnation, you know, condescension, like, you know, being rolling your eyes, sarcasm, all that stuff. And then also ignoring them, stonewalling.
Exactly.
So I feel like those are things that, you know, just memorize and avoid and find the antidote to those things, which we could go over different ways to communicate that are more effective. So if you're somebody who can't tolerate a lot of emotion and talking, which happens sometimes, I don't want to stereotype with men, right? I think research shows that they get more physiologically aroused sort of like when they're talking and they can't take it as much
conflict.
As women could go on forever, you know?
Definitely.
Yeah. So I think that it's important to have some rules and say, I tell my couples like, hey, take a time out. but also say you're going to talk within 24 hours or whatever it is, make an appointment to deal with it when you're calmer. That's one thing. And I forget already the question. Sorry.
Okay. Well, you know, it really goes back in some ways to love types, her approach to respecting and appreciating the other person's style. Because remember, the introvert does want to, you know, think about things and maybe get back to the person. The extrovert wants to talk immediately. So learn how to respect and appreciate that style in each other. It can be a very positive thing. Or maybe, you know, the person is very spontaneous and can be a little bit messy and disorganized, and the other person is very structured and organized. How to really respect each other instead of tearing each other down. Because we often project onto our partner what we think we are. So, you know, I don't know if you're are you structured or spontaneous, Paulette?
I don't know. I think I really need to look at your book again.
Were you messy? Are you messy, late, and disorganized, or on time, organized?
Oh, yeah. Me and my son are always like, they laugh at me because I go every 45 minutes, usually with my clients all day. Yes. So even on the weekends, I'm like, me and my son plan out a million things for us to do on Saturday. So we'll set the alarms, and now he's doing it. And my husband's like, oh, no, because my husband's always like a little late, more spontaneous.
Okay. So you're the spontaneous one, and he's probably the more structured one, would you say?
No. I was saying I'm the more structured one with setting my alarm all the time. Uh-huh. Yeah. And my son is. And then my husband's more a little late and spontaneous.
I see what you're saying. I guess, you know, if you're the structured person, you got to appreciate they bring fun into the relationship. You know, they bring flexibility. And you help them get places on time so they don't lose their bus or something and get their car repossessed or something.
Right. You make things happen.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So that's something that I guess people can learn from each other, right? How to appreciate that their differences.
I agree. I lost track of your question for a minute, but I do think you were saying something about like accepting people the way they are. And I think that's a good point because opposites sometimes attract, so that you can learn from each other, and also to try to look when you're judging the other person and see the benefit of what they bring.
Now, are you also intuitive, Paulette? Because when you say you lose track, are you like a person with a lot of ideas in your head at all times?
Oh yes.
Okay. I'm
no, my husband laughs at me because I'm like, oh my god, I have an idea, and then he like rolls his eyes.
Okay. So you got ideas coming out of everywhere, right, that you have?
Yes.
Probably. Now the other thing, this is interesting, Paulette, is dealing with crisis, because in a marriage, you know, there might be a health problem, one or both of them, maybe someone dies, maybe they have financial losses, maybe they have some kind of deep emotional wound from childhood, maybe they get depressed or anxious. So how do they help each other? Should they be therapists to each other? I mean, obviously they can get professional help, but to what level should partners help each other psychologically?
I think to the extent that they can, and so that it's not affecting them adversely as well. I mean, I had breast cancer. My husband was supportive. Sure. In fact, I'm fine now. It was like 7 years ago, but thank you. Okay. And it's funny because you said, should they be therapists? Well, we're both therapists. So he was a therapist, but I still think that I ended up having like a spiritual teacher that I spoke to, or it could have been a therapist. And that was really helpful to me because it was just someone there to support me. And I feel like, you know, your spouse is going through their own thing. So they might need their own person, or, you know, just to recognize that, because it is such a really hard time, like something like that, where you lose all your hair and you go through chemo and surgeries and you don't know if you're going to live for a while, you know, that's pretty traumatic. So I think couples, I mean, actually the stats, I did an article for a cancer magazine about, I think it's dating and marriage and when someone has cancer as an example, and they found so many more marriages split up because it is just really like almost a dark night of the soul.
Yes.
However, you know, it goes a long way when someone's going on date nights with you when you're bald and really, you know, treats you the same. So it can actually work either way. It's an opportunity or a crisis. And it's a chance for both of you to really learn a lot. So
That can be like true love. You know, agape love is unconditional. And when you stay with your mate no matter what, that's very beautiful. It's a spiritual thing. But I'm also thinking, you know, when one of them is hurting, how much can the other one help them? Now, we hear terms like codependency, and that could be a negative thing. But at the same time, nurturing each other could be very positive. So where do you see that as a line in terms of helping each other, you know, when one's suffering and the other one can be the helper?
Well, you don't want it to always be one way, or that's the sort of codependent thing, right? When one person kind of loses their own needs and then is always helping the other person.
Right. But what if they take turns helping each other?
Yeah, that's what I was about to say. I was going to say it's really ideal, and I don't see this always happening with my couples, when one person's stressed out and has a crisis and the other one's kind of okay and then can have the resources to help. Yeah. However, what happens, I see a lot in therapy, is that there'll be an outside crisis, say something with your kid, or for example, right now my mom has Parkinson's and we're really the caretakers, and it's just a lot that I'm mostly dealing with, and he helps out. But I mean, so if it's happening to both of you and you have opposite defensive styles, right, then that can be a lot. And you both might need your own supports or your own time apart to, like, you know what I mean, to kind of regroup or process it the way you process it, and to know your partner's defensive styles, hopefully ahead of time, is one thing I work with couples around, so that when something like that does hit, hopefully you can recognize the patterns and what's going on and not just take it personally and, you know. Because you're feeling wounded at that time, or just your resources are just way down, your stress level.
The other thing that we see a lot is the idea of the big love picture, you know, having your relationship or marriage in perspective. Because as you say, you know, you have the bills and the kids and maybe fight over sex or family issues or finances. So the key is to remind yourself why you got together with this person in the first place. What are the great qualities about them? Why you love the person today and what it means for a future. And I also talk about, you know, maybe a higher purpose for being together if you have a spiritual practice or some kind of belief system, and seeing the big picture. Now, how do you get people to do that, to see the big picture in their relationship when everything seems to be against them?
I think it's really important. I have a chapter in the marriage book I'm writing about that saying, begin with the end in mind, right? And it's very easy to look at the pet peeves and all the shoes on the floor and all the, you know, the cabinets open
and stuff, and all
that's it. That's it. You know, I need somebody neat and you're gone, you know?
Yes.
But if you think 10 years into the future and you think about that book by, I think it's Malcolm Gladwell or something, that says that it takes, like, I don't know if it's 10 years or 10,000 hours to become a master or something, you know, marriage is no different. Uh-huh. And so to look at how you'll be when you're retired and you're strumming guitar and singing together or going on cruises or whatever, and you know, the same perspective, that perspective on your problem now, and then work backwards. Uh-huh. And I think also to think, you know, to go into your higher self and not your ego and say, like, what would love do here? And, like, what is there to learn here? And then that's a different perspective on the same issue. It's really like the level of consciousness
so
you bring.
So I'm kind of wondering how many hours you think it would take to be a master at marriage. If you even,
I'll let you know when I get there.
Okay.
I've only been married 12 years.
Oh, okay. Well, 12 years, theoretically is 40 hours a day. I don't know, 50 days, 50 weeks a year, right? I
would think. 40 hours a day. I don't know about your day.
40 hours a week,
24.
Actually.
Feels like 40 hours a day.
Okay. Yeah, think about it. Well, you're together with a person, I don't know, how many hours do you think a person's together with their partner? About 16 hours a day?
Well, we're not actually together all that much. I don't know about everybody else, but we both work a lot and we have kids. So, but I mean, we try to really have a date night every week for like 4 hours or something, and to have Saturdays all together as a family and spend some of Sunday and then, you know, like at least an hour every day. So
I see. So speaking of this whole idea, what else do you recommend for people to keep that spark alive in their marriage? I know you have the ritual baths, which I'd like to talk about in a little bit, but what else do you think is good for couples, you know, to keep that spark alive?
So definitely, I don't know if I mentioned to you date night, but the research shows that couples are like 3 times as happy. Their sex lives are at least double or triple as good.
Yes.
You know, their divorce is 3 times less. So it's just unbelievable just from a weekly date night. And a large majority of couples spend at least weekly time together. And I think when I recommend that to couples, and I long have before that study came out, I always say, you know, try to have fun, try to be kind of look good and be your best and not be fake or anyway, but talk about interesting things instead of, like, you know, when you go to a steakhouse and you see a couple that's been married a lot of years and they have nothing to say to each other because they feel like they know the person already.
Yes.
And so they kind of stop being curious. And I don't know if you ever had that experience, but like your spouse will, you'll have people over and will start talking about their job in a new way. And you're like, I didn't know that because they just think that you did, you know?
Yes.
So, so I think that's really, really an important ritual. I think other rituals are like kissing each other hello and goodbye and saying, I love you. There's the rule of fives, which is that for every negative thing you say five positives, things like that. So, I mean, things that you would do naturally when you're dating that sort of fall away.
Okay.
When you've been, you know, the person becomes more like furniture because you've been together a long time.
Yes. Now, actually, you know, you've actually influenced me, Paulette, because I recently put in a jacuzzi in my bathtub. And I really I like it. And I know that you are a bath person. You even have a book called Sacred Baths. And the whole idea of making that with your partner, right? Getting into a bathtub and all that. And tell us some more about that, because that sounds like a very interesting idea.
Thank you. When I actually discovered the whole bathing thing when I was on my spiritual journey with the cancer and I needed time to meditate. So I started doing it myself, and then I invited my husband to do it for a free date night. And we really enjoyed it. And then I started creating baths, at least a section of the bath book for couples, both for daters and also for married couples around different issues. And I just find it to be a really nice way. It's, it can be romantic, but also it can be spiritual. It's almost like an attunement ritual. And I think some men would like it because even though they may not like baths, but because they don't have to talk really. And it's relaxing and it's like a nice transition from your day. Because I think couples bring in a lot of day residue, a lot of stress. And so they need that kind of time to transition and to sort of get to a better place before they connect.
Exactly. And then I guess the sexual intimacy would improve, I would imagine, since you're being with the person in a relaxed way.
So I think it's a good way, and it's really inexpensive as well.
Yeah, you told me there's some aphrodisiacs, something called lang-lang, I think you said.
Ylang-ylang, I think it's called,
And it increases aphrodisiacs, so is that desire for romantic desire?
Yes, I don't have it in front of me, and I don't want to disconnect you by going into the room and trying to find my book, but there's one for that's more attractive, I think, to men, and I think Jasmine's one that brings out love. So there's different ones you can use and combine, and like roses for self-love, and it really smells. Also, they smell great, so it's really a sensual experience, right, of the senses, because you have all the beautiful oils, and you can have a candle, which can represent spirit, or, you know, and the lights dim. So it's like really wonderful to have that kind of home spa, because if you don't want to spend money, like we once went to in that really beautiful place called Air Bath, I believe it was.
Oh, really?
And it felt like a cathedral, and it's like highly recommended for couples, and they even have like wine baths and all kinds of wonderful things. But you know, a lot of couples.
And that one's only in New York State where you live?
Unfortunately. I don't know why they don't have a chain. Maybe it'll expand, but it's in New York City.
Wow.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's like based on the Roman baths. They have floatatoriums, and like, it's just amazing. But anyway,
But at home, you recommend something like 25 minutes. I think you said prayer and meditation on the relationship. Is that the timeline, about 25 minutes or so?
Well, I made a goal, because being the Aries that I am, whether it's by myself or with him, usually having it be 20 minutes, because I'm, you know, in the bath and then out, and it starts my day. I mean, obviously, if it's a day night, you're not rushed. You can make it be longer. But, you know, a lot of times people get antsy if they're not used to it. Like, say, a guy doesn't take baths. So it's really just a ritual to pray. You can pray. You can meditate. You can get guidance on a particular area of your relationship. And let any stress down the drain, because you have like the detoxing bath salt and the beautiful senses and the smells. And so it's just a way to really center around a positive intention, to bring in a higher energy, to attune to each other, to let anything negative down the drain, and a romantic ritual. And then you can go kind of reset, almost like a purification.
Yeah, that's really beautiful. So you're combining romance, spirituality, and connection all in one time. Now, is this okay for different religions? I mean, if you're Christian or Buddhist or Muslim, can you still do this?
Perfectly okay, unless, like, you know, there's something I don't know about. But, you know, I'm not very religious, so. But I know that in most of the religions that water is a really important symbol, and including in the Bible. So there's like the mikvah, and the Hindus have a purification ritual. So it is something that is a universal symbol. And you could kind of tailor it. I didn't try to like impose anything on anyone. I made it so people could take it and do what's right for them.
Right. And then I think you also mentioned three elements that can go with this. You said forgiveness, trust, and meaning. How do those three fit into the sacred bath?
Well, I believe, and it's been a while, that I did have a bath ritual on forgiveness, to let anything like that might be stopping you or blocking your heart, and so you can open more to love. So there's that. And you said meaning. I don't know if I had, I think I had one on a shared vision, if I remember correctly, where couples kind of use the bath ritual to imagine like sort of their bucket list or what they want to do together. And then they could go create a collage afterwards. And I have a book on that as well. And what was the other thing you said?
Go back to forget. What if you're mad at your partner for doing something he or she shouldn't have done, and you're with them in the bath? Is that a good time to do this, to forgive them?
I think so. Well, first of all, it's nice to have a forgiveness ritual where you're not sort of rehashing everything. It doesn't mean you don't still need to talk.
Right.
But what I tell my couples is it sounds ridiculous and almost like antithetical, but I tell my couples, like, most people want to talk, myself included, when you're really pissed off. Like, you've kept it in, and then you want to just, like, spew it on the person, right?
Yes.
And then that causes, like, a really negative momentum that really doesn't achieve anything. It might feel good to let it out.
So you start calling each other names, and maybe some people even use profanity. You know, they get kind of bad at that.
Right. So, and I'm sure we're all guilty of this at some point in time, but I'm just saying, like, if you can get yourself to a calmer place first or a neutral place, you can talk about the same content and have a better result. And the research shows that, like, even a large percentage of your communication is tone. So even if you're not, you're holding back and not even saying the content, the partner gets it from the tone and the energy. So to get yourself to a centered place is great. If you can both do it, all the better, right? Because then you're both in a balanced perspective and place. And I think that forgiveness can start on the inside. So, you know, imagining whether you're willing to do that or not, not to force yourself, but maybe the other person's side, seeing their essence, you know, trying to be compassionate about maybe what they were going through. And you know, there are different gods and goddesses and angels for different things. And I can't remember at this moment, but there was an archangel I think I found about forgiveness. And so you can put the ritual and even bring in that higher power. So if you don't feel you alone from your ego self can really reach that place, you could kind of get guidance about what you think that energy would suggest.
Yeah, that's really
for your
cool.
relationship.
That's really cool. And I'm also thinking this is almost like, you know, exposure or systematic desensitization, where you kind of associate a relaxing thing with, you know, maybe a fear or negative state. So someone is maybe upset that, you know, that bath will relax them, the warmth and everything. And maybe they can associate some kind of healing with the anger they had or whatever it was that hurt them. So I can see that happening, you know, psychological way. And the other thing is, I like the spiritual component here, that you're actually elevating the relationship in a higher sense. And I think, you know, having a meaning in your relationship beyond just, you know, procreation or sex or companionship, but, you know, creating light in the world, you know, whether you're a great partner or a great parent or just a good person in general. I think that's a very lovely thing you're doing. Is there anything else? Is there anything else that you're working on? You said a book. Now I'm kind of excited to hear about that. Tell us about the book, if you can.
Well, you know, I'm going to send it to you. I will. I don't know if you'll have time to read it, but so yeah, I'm writing I'm always writing something so similar to you, I think.
Okay.
But
you are. Okay.
And I also want to say that I really like that you're a psychologist and that you actually get the spiritual stuff. So that really makes me happy to talk to you all the time.
Yes.
But anyway, so right now I am writing a book about marriage because I've been doing that work for a really long time. I either work with dating. Or couples, and I already wrote the dating book, so this is sort of the marriage one, and that will be probably ongoing for like some more months. And then also I've been writing about online dating, and specifically a little bit focused on Facebook dating, which is supposed to be coming out, but the joke's kind of been on me because they had said it was going to come out and I was trying to get ready and then it never did because of all the stuff probably that's going on with them. So I really don't know when it's coming out.
I see what you're saying.
But having said that, I really think that because I work with a lot of daters and I do dating coaching, it's going to be a great platform or a very interesting one for those clients because of a lot of advantages that they seem to have and a huge audience and, you know, a good amount of money and a data science team and things like this. So I'm interested to see what their algorithm is going to be and to help people to use that platform to meet people.
Yes, definitely. Well, Paulette, it's been, again, very delightful to have you on. You have a very infectious personality. I can see it, sense the emotion coming from you. And also you have a really desire to help people, which is really wonderful.
Thank you.
And that's a spiritual
nature.
It comes through. And where can we hear more about you? And do you have any, are you still doing coaching and things like that? Or what is it that you can offer folks?
I am. My website is www.drpaulettesherman.com. And on there, I have two Udemy classes. I don't know if I ever told you that. One, both on dating and one on actually spiritual parenting to get your kids off the devices and learn about spirit.
Oh, that's it.
So three classes, actually. And then I'm probably going to be doing teleclasses in the future. And it has a link to all my books, which at this point is probably like 23 or 24.
Wow.
So
you're pretty prolific now. So you're not the technology person that's always on the phone and internet, or do you just put it away for a little bit?
Don't like it, but I have to say it becomes a habit because people are reporters are emailing me. So I am on it, unfortunately, but I prefer not to watch a ton of TV. And beyond that, I prefer to be creative and
exactly. So tell us your website
things.
One more time, Paulette, so we have it.
So it's www.drpaulettesherman, drpaulettesherman.com, and I do coaching both for couples and for daters.
Excellent. So Paulette, now I'll give you an invitation. Now you got to tell me, are you going to see me in Miami in October for the big Festival of Books, if you can make it?
Well, I would love to. Number one, I would love to see you, and I would love to, anything with books I love. So yes. I would love to be there. But I was already telling you, we're saving in little buckets for
Okay. Let's make your book a bestseller. So you have the abundance, right?
All right. I'm totally with you. I promise I'll come to Dr. Bill, I swear.
Yeah, law of attraction, right? Make it a bestseller, and then you can have the means to travel. And
when is it again? I have to put it up to the universe.
I think it's in October, October of this year, so it'll be in October.
All right, let's do that, because I'll put in my full moon wishes. I think yesterday was the last day.
It's abundance, right? And definitely, I'd love to have you back on. I'm going to be doing some live podcast kind of stuff, so we'd love to have you come back.
Thank you.
Always,
I'd love to.
It's always a pleasure. So again, Dr. Alex Avila, this is Love University. And if you want to reach us at lovetype4u@AOL.com, that's LOVETYPE, the number 4, letter U at AOL. Visit us at loveuniversity.love. Call us at 310-226-8090. Like us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Until next time, Dr. Alex Avila, it's been a pleasure, Cheryl, and have you on board. And we're going to see you next time. Put away your books, notepads, and we'll see you. Love University.